Friends, we are very fortunate to have as our guest speaker today Janine Miller. Janine was just telling me that she was born in China of French parents and then lived in Australia, was raised in Australia, and has lived in England for 30 years, so that if you're wondering about her accent, it is a truly international one. Janine is the author of several books, including The Vision of the Cosmic Order in the Vedas and The Vedas Harmony, Meditation, Fulfillment. Two of your books, Janine, are over on the bookstall, are they? Two of the books are available on the famous bookstall in Herringham Hall. Janine has been a member of the Theosophical Society for 35 years and has lectured throughout the world for the TS. And in our little wording on the program, we've said, Janine Miller believes in the cooperation of all organizations following different esoteric paths. That is something which we all share, I'm sure. And we also share a heartfelt interest in her topic today, which is the Ageless Wisdom Teaching in its modern presentation. We thought it very right and appropriate that we have Janine speak at our conference this year, because I happen to know that in the course of her talk, she's going to be looking at some of the great spiritual pioneers who have brought forth the modern presentation of the Ageless Wisdom, especially Helena Blavatsky and Alice Bailey. Jim mentioned earlier that we are very aware of the cycle in the Alice Bailey teachings of crisis, tension, and emergence. And this year is a year of tension and expansion within that cycle, influencing the work of all world servers. Well, as we know, the Ageless Wisdom has been one of the great keys to enable humanity's point of spiritual tension to reach such a focused and elevated state that it is of true usefulness to the Christ and the hierarchy. And the influence of the Ageless Wisdom in its spread over the last 125 years on subtle levels of human thought must be one of the greatest elements or greatest features of modern time, of modern human history. So Janine, we look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you.
Friends, first of all, my thanks, my great gratitude to Janet Nation for having invited me to speak on this panel. It is a great joy because, as she pointed out, I like to bring the various esoteric bodies together. We follow a similar path, and we are trying to bring the light that was given to us to all the people of the world. And it is a shame that so many of us are not standing together to do that. So I hope in my own little way I can do a little bit of just that, coming together. Now you will notice that the title of this talk is The Ageless Wisdom Teaching in its modern presentation. So the first question is, what is the Ageless Wisdom? It is obviously a body of knowledge which concerns the universe and man, which concerns the mysteries of life and death, of evolution, of man's place and capacity of development, and his purpose in the vast cosmos, and his future. Now it is the essence of that knowledge which gives insight into ourselves. Does it work? What is it? Can you hear me? Yes? No?
No.
Here you can hear me. Like that?
Yes.
Like that?
Yes.
awareness of that knowledge which gives insight into ourselves, and this is of the utmost importance, ourselves as the microcosm, and therefore into the macrocosm. And this is found at the root of all religions. Such knowledge was originally imparted to humanity through revelation by higher beings than human beings, called divine beings, who taught humanity and left their mark on the early civilizations. Now, this knowledge was presented in various ways throughout the ages, for example, through myth, through the great stories and epics of mankind, and through the profound art of astrology, of alchemy, and through the so-called mysteries, the mystery tradition, which flourished in Egypt, in India, in Chaldea, in Greece, in the Americas, in the Celtic lands, and so on. Now, the mysteries purported to reveal to man, by means of out-of-the-body experiences, and in later times, by means of dramatic presentations, something of the realms of the beyond, something of the secret of birth and death, of the various states of consciousness, both during life and during death, after death, and also the existence of many of the many beings, the angels that work in the universe and their interrelationship with human beings. Now, the whole teaching culminating in that supreme illumination during which man realized that he was one with the solar splendor, one with deity. The rishis of ancient India said, "I was born even a sun, S-U-N. Now, this body of knowledge has been preserved for us throughout the ages in the sacred texts of ancient civilizations, and they have come down to earth. For example, in the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Mahabharata, the Manusmriti, the Bhagavad Gita, in the sacred books of Egypt, the pyramid text, the coffin text, the book of what is in the beyond, the book of gates, the book of the dead, a complete misnomer. It is the book of coming forth by day. In the Popol Vuh of the Quiche Indians of Guatemala, and obviously in all the traditions of the Indians of America, and also in the Quran, obviously, and also in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which shows tremendous insight into the states of consciousness of man, and also in our own Bible, which our literal-mindedness has almost killed. And it all culminated in the great inspiration that Christ gave to the world and his commandment that ye love one another. We may wonder, what have we done with this commandment? But Western humanity as a whole, especially during the last 300 years, has turned away from the wisdom tradition. The language of scripture and its literal interpretation have become barriers to the mind, to the understanding of the inner wisdom. The language of scripture is the language of the psyche. It uses myth, metaphor, poetry, symbol. A symbol relates, links, connects the inner and the outer, the beyond and the hither, the infinite and the finite, the subjective and the objective. Now, this particular kind of language has receded behind our conscious mind, giving way to the rational way of looking at things, and brain terminology and metaphoric language do not go together very well. One uses facts, the other symbols which cannot be taken literally. Myth is a Greek word, mythos, which means the word spoken in a mystery. What does it mean to the ordinary person? It means something unreal, non-factual. Very often it means just a lie. When we dismiss something as a myth, we mean it's not real. Now this is wrong. What does the word mean? The word spoken in a mystery. The word is the resonance, the vibration of the soul, psyche. Psyche reacts to life by vibrating, by echoing, throwing out its responses as projections upon the screen of the mind, which becomes the screen of the cosmos. It throws out this projection, it throws out its own inner strivings as stories, its own longings, aspirations, conquests. Its conquests of the forces of darkness, of selfishness, of ignorance. All these are expressions of the soul striving. So we find, what do we find? We find sleeping beauty awakening at the touch of the divine lover, the spirit. We find Indra, the warrior mind, rending asunder the dragon of chaos and releasing the waters of space and setting the sun on high for all to see. And we find the God-man born in the stable of the human body, in the cave of the human heart. All these are grand symbols of certain realities of the spirit out of all relation to the realities of daily life. But they are there, and they need a language. To dismiss them as puerile, fanciful, unreal, and emphasize only factual realities is to miss the very inwardness, the very core of true life. But this is what we have done. The result has been a plunge into abysmal materialism and selfishness, profound demoralization, rampant immorality, and desecration of Mother Earth. Now, this kind of demoralization and materialism was speeding headlong in the 19th century. And in order to somewhat arrest this trend and to give renewed hope to some portion of mankind, a messenger was sent to the West to give back in modern language the essence of the divine wisdom. This messenger was Madame Blavatsky, the first pioneer in the re-establishment of the ageless wisdom in the West. But like all pioneers, she was attacked, vilified, branded, criticized savagely, and to this day her name still suffers from vicious condemnation and ignorant criticism. But her message has survived, and it opened it opened tremendous horizons, and the whole unfoldment of the esoteric studies and the many movements involved in it can be traced back to the mighty inspiration that she gave, and to her we owe an immense debt of gratitude. Now Blavatsky, or HBB as she was known, reformulated and explained in modern language what was hidden and scattered in the scriptures of the world. Her monumental work is The Secret Doctrine. This is based upon the stanzas of Dzogchen, and Dzogchen means dhyana, meditation. And these stanzas are probably taken from the books of Kyute, which are or were in Tibet, but I believe some of them have been rescued and are in America. In that book, based upon those stanzas, she gives one of the grandest visions of the history of our planet that has ever been granted to man. She said herself that she was giving nothing new, which is possibly a bit exaggerated because she gave a lot of her own knowledge. But she brought back to life the ageless wisdom which had laid dormant in the very scriptures. To this wisdom she gave the name Theosophy, Theos Sophia. And she said, Theosophy is not a religion, nor is its philosophy new. It is as old as thinking man. Its tenets are not now published for the first time, but have been cautiously given up to and taught by more than one European initiate. Nevertheless, most of what she brought out in her books was new to the public, but the essence of it was known to the Christian mystics. And I wonder if some of you know this poem, of which I'm going to quote just the last three stanzas. With wide embracing love, thy spirit animates eternal years, pervades and broods above, changes, sustains, dissolves, creates and rears. Though earth and moon were gone, and suns and universes ceased to be, and thou wert left alone, every existence would exist in thee. There is not room for death, nor atom that his might could render void, since thou art being and breath, and what thou art may never be destroyed. Now for me, this is the essence of the ancient wisdom, of yoga philosophy, of the secret doctrine. And it was written by someone who knew nothing of these things, Emily Bronte. But she was a mystic and she had the divine wisdom in the very core of her soul. Now for the teachings. HBB pointed out what we all feel, that the great stumbling block to the understanding of the ageless wisdom has been the many gods and the one God. So she showed that the many gods were only aspects or divine manifestations of the one. In ancient Egypt, they called them the limbs of the Godhead, only aspects. That the idea of the Godhead was never dragged down to man's measure as we have done in the West. That there was always reverent silence concerning the absolute, for fear of desecrating the very idea of the Absolute. Now this is borne out in the Upanishad, where reality is called not this, not that. It's borne out in the Rig Veda, where deity is that which breathes out breathlessly. That whose shadow is death, whose shadow is immortality. She explained that nothing is permanent except the one hidden absolute existence, which contains in itself the noumena of all realities. Nevertheless, all things are relatively real, for the cognizer is also a reflection, and the things cognized are therefore as real as himself. She pointed out that man is a spark of the divine and that his future therefore has no ending. Madame Blavatsky made certain revelations which, although they are scattered in the Hindu scriptures and are expressed in an antiquated form there, were never given out so clearly, so boldly to the world at large. Now I have enumerated some of them. The first one is that evolution is cyclic and involves the spiritual, the mental, and the physical. That the divine monads circle round through various planets or globes of various density and through each of the kingdoms of nature, reaching the human kingdom and passing beyond, which implies that mankind is not the acme of evolution, but one among many fields of experience. provided for the monadic life. Thirdly, that the same souls return again and again to their respective field of expression and experience in accordance with the law of cause and effect, action and reaction, or karma, sowing and reaping the harvest of their own sowing until such time as all lessons have been learned and they can pass beyond this earth experience. Nothing like this had ever been given out publicly for 2,000 years, but we do have hints of this in the Christian tenet, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. This law of cause and effect is indeed found in the Bible and its corollary, reincarnation. I wrote an article on that because many people are not aware that this law is in the Bible and in the Christian New Testament. And are we aware of the apocalyptic vision of the end of the cycle given out in St. Mark's Gospel and explained by Blavatsky, after which vision Christ himself says, "Verily I say unto you, that this generation shall not pass till all these things be done," and all these things have not been done. So the issue hangs upon the word generation. Does it apply only to the generation to which Christ was speaking, or to the particular generation of evolving souls in this particular cycle, which would make it much wider? But in our puny minds, we never think of that. Fourthly, a further revelation was given out, namely, that some of those highly evolved souls from past cycles, masters of the wisdom, formed here on earth a nucleus of brothers, adepts of the good law, called the Great White Brotherhood, or the Hierarchy, remain here on our planet for the protection and the guidance of mankind. And this nucleus is steadily growing through taking in more and more human members who have made the grade. From this hierarchy of perfected souls, messengers are sent out to the world, helpers who originally, ages ago, taught humanity the arts of civilization and government. That was also quite a revelation. Who appeared as the great rulers in the dim past of the divine dynasties. And it is interesting to note that when Champollion, the great decipherer of the Egyptian hieroglyphs, was faced with the king's list, he saw the gods reigning on earth. The names of the gods were written as the kings of early Egypt. Now we understand what is meant by that, but the scholars wonder, what on earth is that? The gods reigning on earth? And also they appeared as great teachers of the wisdom. And looking back over history, we see obviously Osiris and Isis in Egypt, Hermes, Moses, Lao Tse in China, Confucius, Pythagoras, Mohammed for the Arabs, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, Krishna, the Buddha, Jesus Christ, and nowadays they are still with us. And I think Sai Baba is one very great one, and there is another very great one, but for the moment he keeps a very low profile. Whether we shall recognize him or not is another question. Other followers of the divine wisdom and messengers have come, smaller ones, but still very important. And Madame Blavatsky was one of them, she admitted it. Annie Besant, Helena Roerich, and her husband, who gave out wisdom through his painting. Alice Bailey, Geoffrey Hodgson. I think that of those who may not have been completely conscious of having been sent by the hierarchy, we might count Gandhi, I mean, that's a personal opinion, but I think Gandhi was a great messenger. He did a great task, performed a great task. And Steiner, and that enigmatic figure, Krishnamurti, but many others, probably. Now, realize that divine messengers are always sent to mankind in times of need. And the Bhagavad Gita tells us, wherever there is decay of righteousness and there is exaltation of unrighteousness, then I myself come forth. Deity sends incarnations. This is the teaching. The hierarchy sends messengers. This is the modern way of putting it. So-called incarnations, messengers to help, to reform, and to teach, and to guide. Now, Blavatsky pointed out that contrary to Christian belief, all spiritual pathways, regardless of their particular religious denomination, help their followers to achieve the goal, whatever the goal be called. Adeptship, nirvana, deliverance, salvation, and so on. This also is put in the Bhagavad Gita. However men approach me, even so do I welcome them, for the path men take from every side is mine. Now you can be sure that everything that is really of substance in the ageless wisdom is in the Bhagavad Gita, one of the greatest scriptures of the world. It is easily imagined that the Christian or the church world could not accept this broad-mindedness, this all-inclusive philosophy, and Blavatsky had to suffer from that. This vast movement towards an integrated humanity and unbounded compassion for all, without distinction of race, caste, sex, creed, or color, started with Blavatsky's profoundly human and divinely revealed message. Sent to a terribly materialistic, arrogant, self-conceited, and skeptical Western world. But it did its work. Annie Besant continued the work, consolidated it, simplified it so that the less cultured, the more simple-minded would be able to follow her. And I would like to quote to you from Alice Bailey's autobiography. I think she puts it very well concerning the two pioneers, Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant. Let there be no mistake. The movement initiated by HPB was an integral part of a hierarchical plan. There had always been theosophical societies down the ages, but HPB gave it a light and a publicity that set a new note and that brought a neglected and hitherto somewhat secret group out into the open and made it possible for the public everywhere to respond to this very ancient teaching. The indebtedness of the world to Mrs. Besant for the work that she did in making the basic tenets of the Theosophical Society teaching available to the masses of men in every country is something that can never be repaid. There is absolutely no reason why we should overlook the stupendous, magnificent work she did for the masters and for humanity. This is one of the greatest tributes paid to HPB and Annie Besant. Paid by a great soul. And I would like to speak of Alice Bailey as the successor, the real successor of Madame Blavatsky, in the spreading of further insight into a magnificent vision which was given to us by the masters, by those who stood behind HPB and Alice Bailey. Helena Roerich is another such messenger, but I find that she's not in a direct line of communication. Hers is completely intuitive. It is magnificent, but it applies to the intuition purely. And for that, we need silence. I have to speak. So I will concentrate for a few moments on Alice Bailey. Because of its magnitude, its intrinsic wisdom and tremendous insight, it obviously comes from the very same source as that which inspired Madame Blavatsky. Now, her two monumental works are the Treatise on Cosmic Fire and the Treatise on the Seven Rays, the latter comprising, as probably you all know, five volumes of concentrated teaching. The Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which Alice Bailey herself describes as the psychological key to the secret doctrines, deals with the most secret and ungraspable and dangerous of powers, fire. Fire is used by spirit, by mind, and by the deva. And in ancient India, they knew the three fires, fire by friction, or matter, material fire, fire, solar fire, or deva fire, and electric fire, or spiritual fire. The secret doctrine gives only hints based upon the Indian scriptures. The Treatise on Cosmic Fire takes up the subject and expounds it. Expounds the working of the three fires and their infinite correlations as they manifest and work from the atom to man, to the planet, to the solar logos, and to even beyond. It gives us a magnificent glimpse into the cosmos, and we bow in humility and awe at this vision that no human being can really grasp. Only a mastermind could have expressed it. The mind is constantly stretched from the microcosm to the macrocosm. But time is running and I have to speak a little bit more on certain subjects. Now, the Treatise on the Seven Rays gives us a great deal of information on a subject which had been completely unknown in the West. This is the subject of the rays, said to be the sum total of the divine consciousness or universal mind. It is said that they can be regarded as seven streams of qualified life force, seven intelligent entities through whom the divine plan is working out. They embody the divine purpose, express the qualities of deity, and so on. This reveals that there is a divine plan, that there is a divine purpose. And also it reminds us and gives us the key to what the scriptures hint at when they speak of the seven archangels behind the throne or before the throne, the rishis of ancient India, the seven amsha spans of the Zoroaster, and of course the seven heavenly men of the esoteric tradition. All this brings the universe a little bit closer to us in the sense of realizing somewhat better the interlinkedness of all things. If our puny mind could synthesize all this information, it would gradually apprehend the immense vision of the grand man of the heavens, which again is portrayed in the ancient scriptures of India, in the Rig Veda, for example, where it is said, thousand-headed, thousand-eyed, thousand-footed is Purusha, heavenly man. Having pervaded the earth on every side, he extends beyond. Such is his mightiness. But far greater than this is the heavenly man. One-fourth of him encompasses all beings. Three-fourths of him abide immortal in heaven. Now, many more revelations were made by Alice Bailey. I shall only enumerate them. One was the presence in the world of the new group of world servers, and you know all about it, I'm sure. This being a prelude to the return of the masters of the wisdom among mankind, and indeed the return of the Christ for which she worked so much, and which has taken momentum since her death, tremendous momentum, and thousands are following a particular movement in Japan, even all over the world, and the possibility of hastening human evolution by means of specific training, whereby man may become more efficient servants. More information was given about the cycling in of the new ray, the seventh ray, the ray of ceremonial order, which is ushering in the new age of Aquarius, which brings together, governs the relationship between the dualities, which fosters cooperation, collaboration, togetherness, unity, harmony, all these things for which we are yearning, and which will bring closer contact between the human and the Deva kingdom. In this respect, there is one pioneer who is little known, possibly here, Geoffrey Hudson, who has done tremendous work in his clairvoyant investigations concerning the Deva kingdom. And his contribution to Deva knowledge will be of immense importance in the next century. I cannot go into details. Obviously, we are bound by time, so I can only conclude now. What have we done with this wisdom? That is a great question. We have now accumulated a tremendous heritage of the ageless wisdom, expressed in a language which we can understand, even though Madame Blavatsky's language is already said to be out of date. I don't agree, but that's what they say. And what are we doing with this heritage? Are we capable of assimilating it? Do we know that the occult path or the path of occult knowledge is fraught with danger to the unwary? Not the least of which being ego inflation and madness. Hence the age-old stress on ethics and self-oblivion. In order to experience the truth given out, which is really the next step for us, truth which until now we can only view intellectually, we have first to face ourselves with courage, with sincerity, and with determination to right what is wrong in ourselves, not in someone else, no, in us. In order to harmonize ourselves, to integrate ourselves. This is the essence of the ageless wisdom. Integration, integrity, oneness. These words mean one, integer means one. Then only will come the inner revelation and the validation of the ageless wisdom. We need to validate it at the altar of our own being. This is a call, a clarion call to every one of us. Geoffrey Hudson summed this up in the occult diary, in his occult diary thus. One of the most important of all opportunities available to students of Theosophia is increasingly to transfer and transmute acquired knowledge of doctrines into direct and increasingly rich and deep experience in consciousness, a silent inward comprehension. Indeed, we have received, we must give to those who are less capable of receiving. Give them in our own way because we have assimilated the ageless truth. We must experience them in our depth, and only then shall we be able to sing with the ancient rishis, "I have known this mighty Purusha, refulgent as the sun beyond the darkness. Only by knowing him does one overcome death. No other way is there to go."